Hello, everybody. It's Gary Stuckey with Real Music right here on Anchor.fm and Spotify and Apple Music at all points in between. You can hear this podcast everywhere. I think it's on Mars, just saying. But I got an awesome interview lined up for you today. Chris Impellitteri is here. Say that name three times fast and then spell it. I'm just saying. But the guy can smoke on the guitar and the band rocks. You need to check it out if you haven't heard it already. Brand new compilation album coming out on September 30th called Wake the Beast. And no, it's not called Wake of the Beast. Like I said, when I first started talking to him, I said it wrong. It came out wrong. So I apologize. He's probably thinking, Wake the Beast, numbskull. So I apologize. Wake the Beast, coming out September 30th, just in time for Chris's birthday. That's right, going to celebrate with that album. And the songs are awesome. Yeah, if you haven't heard the band, go back and listen to the music, but this is a great way to check them out. You're going to love it. Also, they got some new music coming up pretty soon after that, so get excited, get ready. But here we go. Here he is. Here's Chris Impellitteri. Hello, this is Gary.
Gary, hi, this is Chris Impellitteri.
Chris, how's it going?
Good. I apologize if I'm a little bit early.
No, you're good. All good. Hey, your voice, you've got that voice for the radio.
It's perfect. So you're saying new career change inevitable?
Hey, you never know. You know, hey, we'll swap places. And I'm nowhere near as good as you on guitar. I try, but I'm just saying. Just not even close.
You may be better and not even know it.
Hey, no, I don't. I tell you what, been jamming out to your music. So, you know, I'm loving it. Yeah, a lot of good music, you know, over the years, right? And you've got a brand new compilation coming out, right?
Yeah.
Wake of the Beast is the name of it, right?
Well, it's definitely... probably over 20 plus years, you know, it's kind of like the best of records that were always released in places like Japan and nowhere else in the world.
Right.
So, you know, we've had a lot of, I almost want to call it pent up demand, you know, with our, I like to call them our friends and, you know, family around the world that support the band. You know, unfortunately, a lot of them had to pay pretty exorbitant prices, yeah. You know, to buy them as imports or exporting them from places like Japan. So, we finally just realized now that we have legal rights where we can do it. So let's release it everywhere now.
Right. Yeah, that's a good thing. Yeah, somebody's like, I want to hear this album, but you're going to pay like $200 or three, whatever. It, you know, I don't know.
Well, I can't even imagine how much the
might be more than that.
I'm sure they're not that much, but they're probably expensive.
It's a rare thing though to get those things. But yeah, that's cool for the fans because they're all together. And but how do you decide what songs are going to go on in the box set?
That's really, you know, it's interesting that you ask that because normally, you know, you think we're going to go to our favorite. It like songs are like your children, right? It's hard to pick your favorite.
Right.
And to be honest, as an artist, you know, look, I mean, there are times where we get married to a song and we don't really have a clear perspective of whether it's good or bad, you know, so we favor it. And so what we actually do is over the years, especially the concerts we play in Europe and Japan, you know, we kind of know what the audience want, what they expect, and they've kind of always given us input. So, you know, that was a huge portion of it was really fan input. And then we kind of did, and I feel like it's like we're spying, but occasionally we'll go on like the YouTube links or whatever, where people will put us up on whatever the torrents are or the bootleg stuff.
Yeah.
And kind of read opinions, right? Do people like it or do think it sucks or whatever?
Right.
And you start to see a trend of, oh, it seems to be a lot of people really like this, but they don't like that.
Right.
You know, so what we try to do is put on what people really liked versus the contrary.
Well, that
which defeats the purpose.
Makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's what they want to hear. And, you know, that's awesome for the fans. So you've been doing all this for all these years. And so let's go back in time. So how did you get started playing guitar?
Well, my whole beginning with music was really kind of systemic from a tragedy. You know, when I was 9 years old, I lost both my mother and father. Mm. Technically, it was my stepfather, but, you know, he had adopted me. So,
right.
You know, I lost my parents at 9 years old, and I was adopted by my grandparents, who, thank God, were young. And my grandmother kind of knew if I didn't have some outlet in life to vent, right? A little
Right.
bit of the frustration of
Right.
one day going to bed and waking up as an orphan is like, I'd probably be screwed, right? Getting in
Wow.
trouble, et cetera. So she really encouraged me to take music lessons. And initially, I probably wanted to be a drummer. And I think she probably realized bad idea for her sanity, right?
Yeah, right.
So basically, she took me to a music store. I'll never forget. It was called Mundell's Music. And on the wall was a copy of a Gibson Les Paul Custom in black and a copy of a Stratocaster. And she basically let me choose. I think I remember it was like $137 for the guitar.
Right.
And then she literally paid for me to take lessons, God bless her soul,
Wow.
for like the first 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
You know, so I really learned music theory. And I got to be honest, as soon as I picked up the guitar, I just felt like it was an extension of my personality. It was just this, it was like something where I could express myself, you know. Fell in love with it. And at that point, I think in some way she may have regretted it because now I didn't want to do anything but play guitar.
Right.
You
And
know.
you probably cranked it up real loud too at night, you know, too.
Especially when I had the amp, of course, absolutely.
It's 12 o'clock. You forget sometimes you're jamming. It's like there's people sleeping. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Exactly.
Hey, I was just thinking about this earlier though, but you know, you say you go into a you know, a guitar shop, like Guitar Center or something like that. Do you ever go in there like now and kind of act like you don't know how to play and like play Stairway to Heaven like real bad?
Play
And
Smoke on the
yeah,
Water.
Smoke on the Water, and but play it kind of off, you know, and it's kind of sounds crappy, and then start jamming, you know, start doing the wailing on the guitar and
That is hilarious. No, I've never done that, but that
freaking,
is just picturing it is hilarious. I
dude.
love
I thought it'd be cool just to do. I'd freak out if I saw something like
it.
that. But so you're playing guitar, you're waking the neighbors. No, so how did you go from playing guitar and going, you know what, I want to be in a band? What, why did you decide I want to be in a band, I want to do this for a living, you know?
It was an evolutionary step, you know, first starting with guitar, realizing, man, I really like this. And, you know, and of course, another thing that kind of ruined me, not ruined me, but it kind of excited me was when I was, I think it was 11 or 12, my grandmother bought me tickets to, of all things, Kiss. It
Oh,
was either the Destroyer or Rock and Roll Over Tour. It's
right.
at the Providence, I think it was Providence, Rhode Island was the state civic center. And I remember seeing Kiss, and it was just like, oh, this is awesome. You know, the
Wow.
spectacle, the performance. It wasn't about the music, because
Yeah.
I was really already into like Queen and Thin Lizzy and bands like that for the music,
Right.
even Deep Purple, Richie Blackmore.
Right.
But the concert thing was like, oh my God, look at all these people. You can share this art form with like 10,000 or 20,000 people, right, in an
Right.
arena. And I was just like, oh, this is it. So I really, at this point, was really getting hooked on it. Formed our own band, you know, probably like in, you know, sixth or seventh grade, you know.
Right.
Started playing dances, and of course, when Van Halen came out, now I was like, oh man, I want to be that guitar player, you know.
Yeah.
I want to at least try to attempt this, right?
Right.
And so that's where I was really into the whole, you know, develop your playing, master your craft, you know. And that was it, you know. So, you know, we started with like traditional, you know, playing bands, playing keg parties, playing, you know, high school dances, all the way into, all right, now we're in the clubs,
Right.
right? And then from the clubs, which was great, and that's how Rob Rock and I met. We were actually in a club band together where we were playing both original music and covers, but we were playing 5 to 7 nights a week, you
Wow.
know, in
Wow.
New England. So we had so much live performance experience, you know. We also had to learn, you know, cover songs, so we kind of learned how songs were crafted, similar artists, you know. And so, you know, that kind of evolved into, hey, all of a sudden, let's go into studio and record, you know, original music. Let's make this band real, and inevitably, you know, getting a record deal. And hey, you know, we go from the wherever we were going, from the clubs to arenas, you know, and going to different countries. So it kind of, you know, migrated or evolved in those kind of steps.
Right. So how'd you come up with the name Impella Terry as the name of the band? I'm trying to
It
be
was a really
careful.
bad idea.
It's like you know that's the name. You know, I'm sure you love your name, but you know that's a word that the kids, you know, for the spelling bee, spell
Yeah,
Impella Terry.
exactly. I know, man. It's like
E
there's three I's, there's two T's, two L's. Even I'm like, I'm
Yeah.
sorry, what is it? I
Yeah.
say the
If
name Impellitteri. People are like, I'm sorry, what do you
Yeah,
have? Like a
what?
disease, you
Yeah,
know?
right. Yeah, you need to get some shots for the yeah, I have Impella Terry. I can't come to work today. Yeah. Sorry.
You gotta take antibiotics. You know, honestly, it really was systemic because when I was in LA, we started to build a band together. And what was happening at that time when we were in Los Angeles, you'd get together some great players. The problem was everybody wanted to be successful overnight, right? They didn't really want to. I don't. It's unfair to say that they didn't want to work. They did, but they wanted to take the shortest path, right? Least resistance. So you get these great band. You kind of form this band, and you get a buzz around town. And then the singer would quit and go on to a band who just got signed, right? Or the drummer leaves to a bigger band. And, as that keeps happening, the problem is the credibility of the band all of a sudden breaks apart. Like, you can't keep calling the band because three of the original guys are gone now, especially when you build these like cult followings. And, we were getting ready to do our record, and one of our, I don't know if it was a business manager or lawyer, like entertainment attorneys, said, "Hey man, you're into Van Halen." I said, "Of course, I love Van Halen. I mean, that was one of my biggest influences." He said, "Why don't you just use your last name?" And I was a kid, so I'll be honest. I mean, the ego was stroked immediately. Like, oh, okay, that's cool. I could be like an instantaneous Van Halen, not realizing, dude, the name's not easy to say. Van Halen's easy, right? So, but anyway, so I went. Of course, I did it, and we did the very first Impellitteri Black EP, which eventually got picked up by Sony, but in like places like Japan and Europe, it exploded. So at that point, once the name was in, that was it. It was too late to change it. Or at least I like to tell myself that, try to convince myself.
Well, it'd be weird to change it now. Just now we're called Toad. I mean,
Exactly.
I mean, just out of the blue, like, what the heck happened?
Tesla.
Yeah, Tesla. That name's taken. You can't have that name.
It's funny. I was looking at a car. I'm talking to you in the car right now. I'm in Beverly Hills. I look over, there's a Tesla. Tesla, not realizing that's right. There is a band named
Yeah,
Tesla.
right. I actually talked to the singer a few weeks ago. Yeah. So yeah, that's funny. The people are probably looking at you like, what's this guy doing? Well, I know it was a big deal for that EP, that first EP. How excited were you when you got signed and everything for that?
Well, it's like as a kid, I mean, I was really young. We recorded that EP, I was probably 21. I don't know how to explain it. I mean, first of all, I have to be very honest about who we are and as far as what we've achieved, because, I do get a lot of people think, oh man, you guys are really well known, you guys are stars and all that. I've never thought, no, we're not. I mean, if you want stars, I mean, Metallica are like a billion times bigger than we are, right? And we started after Metallica, right? But we've been very fortunate where in certain parts of the world, yes, we have a lot of success. In other places, people are like, "Who are you?" Back to you need antibiotics when we say the name. But when we released that record, that Black EP, I remember the first big thing where I was like, "Oh, this is awesome." We got a lot of coverage in like Guitar World magazine and Guitar Player. And as a guitar player, that was really humbling. It was like, oh, that's so cool. But the big stuff that really worked for us globally, places like in England, there was a really big heavy metal magazine, which I think still exists today. They've just changed their format, called Kerrang magazine. And Kerrang magazine gave us, like, for the review, they gave us 5 out of 5 stars. So as good as you get. Call me an instantaneous guitar hero, blah blah blah. Whether any of it was true or not, it didn't matter. But they really gave us a lot of credibility in Europe. And then in Japan, same thing. There were magazines like Burn Magazine, which is a really big metal magazine. And that was distributed globally, especially in Europe. So immediately, whether people liked us, whether we were good or bad, it didn't matter. People immediately kind of started giving us a lot of attention. It was almost like that 15 minutes of fame thing.
That's, I mean, that, and that helps your ego and everything. It makes you feel like you've accomplished something. And
Well, it just made me feel like, yeah, all the work, because, I'm one of these guys, even to this day, people laugh at me. I still lock myself in my studio and play all day long, always thinking, I want to be better. I want to be better, right? Never, it's never enough. You're always trying to improve. So even as a kid, I was working really hard, and we did that Impellitteri Black EP, although it was a really low budget recording. We literally, it was almost like a live record, put a bunch of, room mics up and go. But you can hear the plane. I mean, we were on fire. We were basically, we kind of felt like we were at the top of our game at that point, and we captured a lot of that, thank God, on tape.
Yeah, that's so awesome to have, and it brings back a lot of memories of fun times recording too, right?
Yeah, it was really, I mean, I look back in hindsight and I just have fond memories of it. It
So
wasn't always easy, but it was awesome.
awesome, yeah. Well, you know, talking about those magazines, I know, I think, is it Guitar World's named you the second fastest player of all time? Was that
You know what? For whatever it's worth, none of that is true.
right?
I shot myself in the foot. After we did the Impellitteri Black EP, there were, I think it might even been Kerrang! Magazine or one of those, European media outlets basically, did something to that effect of said, yeah, Christian Billiter is the fastest guitar player in the world. And by the way, it was never, ever true, nor did I want it to be. But we played off of it, and look, even to this day, yes, I know often I play very fast, but I try to play with melody and with purpose, I promise. It's more about the song than it is about me trying to show off, right?
That's
So,
right.
but having said that, so we got kind of that branded thing, and then when we were doing a record called Stand in Line with Graham Bonnet, the record label asked me to say something, like put a note on the thing. And there was such a huge buzz, and I was trying to be humorous about, I said something to the effect of, I promise my guitar solos will only get faster. Now, I was joking because if you listen to the Black EP, you can't go much faster. It's just, at this point, it's human, it's starting to get inaudible, right? The notes are flying by so fast. So it was kind of like, all right, I was being silly, but they didn't take it that way,
Well, hey.
And it got to the point where then this became a competition.
I
Everybody wanted to be,
understand.
I mean, look, when you're, to be fair, when we're all young, especially as musicians, you want to be the best you can, right? And so when you can learn how to play a really difficult passage, play 30-second note triplets at, 180 BPM or whatever, some crazy thing, then it makes you feel like, my God, this is amazing. I'm inhuman, right? But you forget. And the one good thing about, believe me, there are equally as many people that liked us, hated me, thought I was a wanker. They would say stuff like that in magazines about me. And it was really good for me to hear that because I realized, in many ways, they were right. I was going a little too far with it. And it really made me think, all right, harness this. Kind of like when a rocket blasts off into space, you're harnessing this massive explosion thrust to get you up there. Well, that's the speed and the technique, but you got to harness it and make it have a purpose. And so I learned that very quickly on. So anyways, going back to the fastest guitar player, dude, I want nothing to do with that stuff. It's like I play fast when I want, which is a lot, I know, but
Hey,
but I don't want to be branded like that. I think it's almost like bragging that, oh, I can talk faster than everybody else.
yeah,
Okay, great.
right.
A little silly,
I'm a huge Neil Schon fan, Journey fan.
Love Neil.
And see, he
Love.
plays fast, but it's about playing the right notes, and like you said, the skill of it is playing the accuracy. I mean, it's one thing to play fast, but if you're sounding like a bumblebee and it don't sound good, it's a different thing. But yeah, it makes a difference in the songs too, that it fits the song. It works out, right?
You're absolutely right. Neil has always been very lyrical, and I love him. As a matter of fact, I put something on YouTube. Someone was in, like, we were doing something, like some sort of interview just for a little guitar magazine thing. And I actually went, oh, yeah, I remember this. And I literally, someone took an iPhone and recorded me doing the solo of Any Way You Want It, note
Oh,
for
wow.
note. They put it up on YouTube. It's on there somewhere.
Oh, I had to look that
But
up. Wow.
Neil is, I've always loved this playing, but he's a great example of that. He can shred with the best of them, but he also knows when to dial it back and just play for the song. So he's
Sure.
very lyrical, right? Almost sounds like he's singing with his guitar.
Exactly. That's right. That's so good. Well, you were talking about when Graham came along. Now, that's when you made your full length album, right? So what happened to Rob at that point?
Sure. So the Impellitteri Black EP, like I say, it started getting a huge buzz. We got signed by Sony and Relativity Entertainment. And Rob comes to me and sits me down and lets me know that he's decided to go to a different direction. There was a producer named Dieter Dierks in Germany who had produced the band The Scorpions. And Dieter was assembling a band called Joshua, great player, great writer. And Rob decided to join their band right as all of this is blowing up for us, right? And so I was devastated. It's like, oh my God, what am I going to do? I just lost my singer. Remember, I was telling you about why we called the band Impellitteri in the first place? Here we go again.
Oh boy.
This was a bigger label, so he jumps. And I remember I was like, I'm in trouble. I don't know what to do. I don't have a new record written. We just signed a deal with Sony and Relativity. And so I remember years earlier, I was a kid. I was much too young for this, but Graham Bonnet was in a band called Alcatraz with Yngwie. And they called me and asked me, they heard me play and they asked me if I'd be interested in basically replacing Yngwie. And I remember going to the audition. It was only two guys. It was me and a guy named Steve Vai. And Steve obviously ended up being the guy and perfectly suited for it anyways, because he was much older than me. But at the end of the day, Graham and I stayed really good friends. So when Alcatraz had come to an end, it was around the same time that Rob, you know, left. And I was like in this predicament. So I remember Graham and I started talking and I said, well, you know, this is what I'm doing right now. And he was totally into it. And I remember I wrote the first song, which was actually the song Stand in Line. I actually wrote the riff on a keyboard.
Cool.
And I presented it to him. And as soon as he started singing, I was like, oh my God, this is magical. But it was going to be challenging because remember, in Pelletieri, if you listen to all of our records before Stand in Line, like the Black EP and everything around it, pretty much, you know, we're a heavy metal band. We always have been pretty aggressive metal, almost on the border of thrash with a lot of melody.
Right.
And with Graham, I wasn't certain I could write like that. So I literally said, well, look, I don't want to throw you in that arena because I don't want to have you be uncomfortable. So why don't we do something more like a tribute to what you did with Rainbow? And so to this day, I really think Stand in Line is one of those awkward records where even though I love the song Stand in Line and it certainly put us on the map and MTV and all that,
right,
I never really thought it was a true and Pelletieri record, right, you know, because it sounded, it was almost in some ways a little bit forced.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, how would he do this in Rainbow, right? Always thinking in that manner. But at the end of the day, I've heard from a lot of people and I kind of agree that I think it may be one of Graham Bonnet's best performances on record because he's the star in that record.
Right. And that happens sometimes. I think, you know, things work out to a certain way and you have to go with the flow, so to speak. But you had opportunities later to do kind of what you wanted to do and things like that, right?
Yeah. Well, years later, you know, Rob would obviously come back and we would do all these great records. A lot of them are on this anthology. But then Rob went off for, again, he went off for a thing for like a year or two. And I brought Graham back for a record called System X, which a lot of the music's on there. I think the second track on Anthology is Perfect Crime. Mm-hmm. And really, that was my revenge. I always promised myself, if I ever brought Graham back in, this time we're going to do Impellitary music. Right? And System X actually became one of our fan favorite records. Right. So I guess in theory, I probably could have done it all along. I was uncertain, so I didn't want to, you know, shoot the foot, you know?
Yeah. Well, what was his reaction as far as his understanding of how you recorded that first album and then later, did he understand the difference in those areas?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't remember because, I mean, you know, at that time, you know, it was a difficult scenario. Graham was, you know, he was still in his 30s. I was, what, 22 years old? And, you know, when we started writing, I mean, Graham, he's amazing. I mean, as far as talent, insane. You know, there are very few human beings that can sing the way he can sing, especially right, in his prime.
Right.
You know, when he was young, I mean, I've been in rooms with Dio. I've worked with Glenn Hughes. I've worked with a lot of great singers or been around them. And Graham is one of those guys. He just has a gift. He has a specific sound, right, that makes him who he is. And he has probably the most powerful voice I've ever heard out of any human being. When he sings, it's literally like going to a zoo and hearing a lion roar, right? If you ever heard that, you realize, yeah, whoa, that is unbelievably loud and powerful. That's him singing. It's insane. And right, when he goes up high, he actually hits those notes without going into falsetto.
Wow.
It's almost inhuman.
That's crazy.
So anyways, but, you know, when we were doing Stand in Line, you know, I don't really know how much we had discussed about it. Maybe it was more my feeling of, no, this has got to be more in the direction of what he did with Rainbow than in Pelletieri. And it, you know, it gave him his freedom to just be himself comfortably. When we did System X, I don't know if I really discussed it either, but I intentionally brought the music in where I wrote all the music and it was heavy. It was intentional. You know, and I would say, look, this is kind of the way I hear you singing. I give him an idea, and if it worked, he would basically write lyrics and use that kind of melody. Other times he'd have something better already. You know, but it really did work. And when I listen to that record now, a lot of times I go, wow, that's really good. I kind of wish we would have released that versus Stand in Line initially, you know?
Right. Well, how do you approach an album, like say with Graham, or how do you approach it differently with Rob? How does that work differently?
I got to be honest. So when we'll take Stand in Line out of the equation, right? Because we already know that. But for the most part, all records around Stand in Line before, after, et cetera, I've always just been me. You know, I'm a metal kid at heart, just right from my heart, my soul, and which is, again, it's going to be pretty aggressive metal. There'll be a lot of melodic overtones, shredding solos, all of that. And it really does show you when you listen to the Rob Rock and Pelletieri records versus System X or Graham Bonnet, what they bring to the table, because it's the same exact person writing the music on all these records, but right, the records sound completely different.
Sure.
And that's a testament to both of them. I mean, both Rob and Graham are insanely talented singers, each unique in their own way.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I was thinking about that too, with, you know, talking about Neil Sean, you know, with Journey, you know, when Steve Perry came on board, you know, they were like a rocking band, and then he kind of brought that R&B thing. So Neil kind of changed his style, and the songs changed to adapt to Steve. So it's kind of like the same kind of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Rob, I know Rob so well. I kind of know what he's going to do when he sings. You know, I kind of have that, you know, that impression already. So I hear his voice in my head when I'm writing music. So it makes it very easy. And 90% of the time when I do it and I give it to him, it's he ends up singing exactly the way I thought he would do it, you
That's
know?
awesome. Well, how did the songs come to be? I mean, as far as lyrically and then musically, how do they kind of come together?
So, you know, remember I told you I'm always in my studio playing, right?
Right.
So, like, I mean, there'll be times on the weekends I'm outside Saturday morning hanging out in a lounge chair at my pool, relaxing, but there's a guitar in my hand. So I'm always, you know, shredding, noodling, whatever, practicing, building muscle memory.
Yeah.
And a lot of times I slip and I'll all of a sudden be like, whoa, what was that? And you kind of, you know, you might start playing a riff and it's something you just, I don't know, just come. It's almost like, I know this sounds freaky and weird, but it's almost like, I feel sometimes like I'm this weird vehicle that some higher power channels through me and uses me, you know?
Hey.
Because I don't know where these riffs come from. Sometimes I hear something in my head and I'll be playing and all of a sudden my fingers start to play and I'll go, oh, what was that? And I immediately will grab like something to record it immediately so I don't forget it. And then if I listen back and really like it, from there I go on the journey and let it take me on this adventure to wherever, like, all right, I've got a riff now. So we've got the intro, right, of the song. Now where are we going with a verse? And you know, you kind of slide into it and it takes you into a bridge. All of a sudden you realize, hey, I'm in a chorus, and all of a sudden it's sounding really good, at least to my ears, right?
Right.
So I'm kind of on this adventure and I have no idea why this is coming to me. It just is. You know, same thing when I go into the solo section. You know, all of a sudden, you know, I'll lay down like a click track or whatever, put a drum machine down, start playing with it, and all of a sudden my fingers and whatever, my soul starts expressing whatever I'm hearing in
No,
my head
that's
through my hands, through my guitar, through the amps, it's mic'd, and all of a sudden you realize, oh my God, this is coming to life. Literally, that's how it happens.
no,
I know it sounds
I just
weird, but it's
understand.
true.
No, I agree. It doesn't sound weird to me. I'll say this. I'll say God, you know, gives you all that stuff and the ability to play. So it's probably just channeling all that ability, you know. But yeah, that's pretty awesome stuff. Yeah, when it comes to you and you're like, where'd that come from? You know, you start jamming and stuff.
Yeah. Well, listen, I always give God credit. I mean, without God, I'm nothing. So, but in all sincerity, I've always felt like, yeah, there's something larger, bigger than me. You know, people a lot of times that like our music, they go, dude, I love that riff or whatever. And I've always thought, you know, I'm sure you've done this, you know, where you probably, I don't know, you're driving in a car and all of a sudden something comes in your mind, you start singing or humming it. You don't
Yeah,
know why, right?
right.
It's like, it's the same thing. And there are times where it's like, I feel like, am I hearing the same thing? The only difference is I record it, ends up on a record, right?
Right.
And then if you hear it, you may be going, oh my God, that's awesome. And you may like it because you may have thought of it at some point as well. Because
Right.
I've actually
Sure.
heard bands come out with music going, oh my God, I knew that riff of something I was going to do years ago,
Sure.
right?
Exactly.
Then of course, then you got to fight and stay away from it because I've been guilty of, oh God, I'm getting too close to that riff again. You know, and they did it first.
Right.
But there are times where you hear other artists do something, going, oh my God, I think I played something like that. And then you think, well, there are 12 notes in the scale, right? So you realize, well, at the end of the day, maybe, well, maybe that's what it is. It's repetition.
Well, I think there's so many things that are floating out there. I think these ideas come out there. It's kind of like somebody putting some of these ideas on a table, and everybody has a chance. And the first one that grabs it, hey, there you go. But I think everybody has an opportunity. You know, I think they're just floating out there. I don't know how that works. God says, I'm going to put all these, you know, ideas out there, and somehow we grab them and go, I'm going to use that. Like, maybe you
You know,
snooze, you lose. Yeah.
yeah, you just, I mean, you just, as an artist, everybody knows. I mean, what as soon as you tune the guitar to A440 or half step down or whatever, you're already copying someone else's creation. Someone else created that tuning.
Sure.
So at this point, you're just kind of playing stuff. A lot of times you may be jamming on something, another artist that influenced you. You know, a lot of times I'll play like I'm the One by Van Halen, or I'll play On Fire, you know, the solo. And a lot of times you're doing that, or you're just playing scales and working on a technique. But all of a sudden, like I say, you fall into that riff, and all of a sudden your ears hear it, and you're like, whoa, what's that?
Right.
And now it's time to develop it. Now you go on this, or you get pulled into this black hole, and it takes you on this journey. Hopefully spits you back out in the light, and everything's great, you
Yeah,
know?
right. Well, that happens though, you know. I mean, it's kind of like writing, you know, songs or writing maybe a novel, you know, all the words have already been written, but you arrange them a certain way. There's so many colors already done, but you paint a certain way. You're painting a picture with your guitar, and you do it a certain way, you know, and your brushes or your fingers, you know, and it sounds cool, you know. But that's really awesome. And as far as the, you know, like if you're sitting with the guys, you're coming up with a new song, you know, with your band, how does it all come together as far as, like, you're playing the riff, how do the lyrics come, and how does everything come together?
Well, so the key and most important thing about our band, which I think most people know, especially the people that really have followed us for years, mm-hmm. the key word is band. This has always been a band. It's never been my ego solo show. You know, I know I get lumped in with some of the other, you know, technical players or shredders or solo artists, but it's never been about me, ever. So, yes, I do write most of the music, but without the input from the other guys, it wouldn't be Impellitteri. And what I mean by that is, so whether it's Rob or Graham in the past singing, you know, I can bring them a lyric or a melody idea, but then it either works or it doesn't. And 90% of the time, they end up doing what they do. Right? They bring their ingredients. It's almost like baking a cake, right? We're all contributing. I start with the foundation, right? Bring the basic structure of the song. You know, I give it to James Pulley, our bass player, and James has been with us since 1990. And so he adds his two cents to it, right? Like, you know, his bass parts. We don't tell him what to play. He does it on his own. Same thing with the drummer. Now, we're a little bit like Spinal Tap. We definitely had two drummers in the band.
Yeah.
But so we basically same thing. It's like, here, just do what you do best. We're not going to tell you what to do, right? And so then we go in a lot of times, we'll rehearse the music together, get a feel for how could we do this live. And then we, once it's ready, which could take a while, then we go into the studio and we start tracking.
Right.
That's kind of how the songs work.
And when you get to the, you know, the I guess to the end of the song, as far as listening to it, do you come together as a band and listen, or do you have the final say at this, you know, and says, you know, you say, I don't know, this isn't working, or we need to add this, or, you know, something like that?
Yeah, no, I see where you're going with this. So, you know, I generally produce the records, and I think I've always been really, I've been very driven to make sure our records are as good as they possibly can be, especially with the confines of whatever budgets we're working on. So if I believe in a song, but it's just not there, I'll keep working on it until we get it right.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably why some of our records have taken 4 and 5 years in between releases, because we just constantly, and these records we make are not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, we go into the big studios, we use the best engineers, you know, and
right.
we really try to get everything right, sonically speaking. And then, of course, you know, writing and getting the, whatever that, you know, that magic, that camaraderie and that chemistry between 4 or 5 individual band members, you know, all firing on all cylinders where everything is working together. You know,
right.
So that's kind of how we do the music. So if a song is not, it's just not there, we'll figure out, well, what's wrong with it, and we'll keep working on it until it works.
And would you say that you're a perfectionist when it comes to listening to things like that? Do you keep trying and trying and trying, or is there a point where you go, that's good enough? Or do you keep, you're really perfectionist and you say, I got to get this?
Yeah, I push it. And, you know, to be honest, I think where that becomes systemic, where this came from, I was never happy with Standing Line, mm-hmm. ever. It was one record I had really no control over. I didn't, you know, I don't know if they gave me a producing credit or whatever, but it was really not me. I was playing with a lot of guys that were much older than me.
Yeah.
I was just listening to them tell me what to do. And, you know, when we went to mix, I remember we mixed a record in the record plant in Los Angeles. And the guy who mixed it was a great engineer, worked with Black Sabbath or whatever.
Right.
But the mix, he buried my guitar solos to the point where it was almost inaudible. There was so much effects on it,
wow.
you know. And I know guys like Neil Sean especially got, I think he went into that problem as well.
Yeah.
But it was stuff like that. I was like, you know what, never again. I'm taking this ship, at least the production, and making sure it's powerful, because we're a hardcore metal band. You know, I mean, we got it right. The Impellitteri Black EP, that was more of a live recording, right? But the solo sound great to me on that. The guitar sounds amazing. And so all the records after Stand in Line, all of a sudden you notice our production's huge. It's now starting like, you know, the Black Metallica record.
Right.
Right. We've got all the kick drums are monstrous. Everything is big because right. we're capturing our band live sonically. And when it gets mixed, it doesn't get ruined. It gets, if anything, it gets enhanced.
That's really a good thing, because a lot of times you listen to an album and you hear them live, it's two different bands, two different sounds. But if you capture that, that's a good thing.
Yeah, and that's to be honest why you and I are probably talking. I mean, we have been so lucky, especially in places like Japan and certain places in Europe. And people tell us we make great records, we make great music, we play great. And I'm not saying we're great by any means. I mean this humbly. I'm just kind of reiterating what they tell us. And I think a lot of it is because our dedication, our determination. You know, a lot of times we make these records, we lose money because they're so expensive to make.
Well, what I've been listening to is, I've been jamming. It sounds awesome. And I know the fans are going to be excited. But when you were going through, finding the songs and everything, though, when you're, I don't know, when you're listening to the songs, do you ever go, maybe I could have done this differently, or are you just happy with everything? I know you were talking about your first album, but I mean, are there moments where you said, I wish I would have done this or done that, or are you just happy with everything the way it turned out?
To be honest, I think I'm happy with the way everything turned out.
That's good.
Stand in Line, like I say, is the only record where if I could say would have, could have, should have, the only thing is I would have made it sound more like all the other Impellitteri records. You know, it would have been much bigger, heavier, fatter, you know? But beyond that, no. I mean, in hindsight, are there things we may have done better? Yeah, but then, like, here's something I've been answering with a lot of interviews lately on this new anthology. So I've been getting this question a lot. People go, hey, is this a new remastered remix? I'm like, absolutely not. Why would we destroy or molest what we spent a fortune on trying to create? You know, these are the original records. The reason we're releasing these globally is because for many parts of the world, they've never been available. People had to either get them on imports or there's some crap quality, you know, torrent out there of it, right? So we're finally bringing it to the masses if they want it. You know, it's up to them, but they've got it. But there's no way in hell I was going to go back, hey, let's go remaster. It's like, why? We had the best mastering guys in the world mastering these records.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we had some big guys doing these records. You know, we did Screaming Symphony on for the first two or three records. We had Michael Wagner, who had done Metallica, Ozzy Osbourne. You know, he did a great job on that stuff. So it was like, why would we touch it?
I totally
Make it
agree.
more modern sounding? It's like,
Yeah.
nope.
Make it
It's like taking Van
disco.
Halen 1 and, hey, let's take Van Halen 1 and try to make it sound like, you know, I don't know, you know, Nine Inch Nails or something. It's like, I don't think so.
Yeah, I'll be waiting for the country version of Impellitteri.
Well, that's called 17th century chicken picking.
Oh yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's it.
Instrumental.
Exactly right. Exactly right. That's good. Which I love. So you the box set that comes out on the 30th, right?
Yeah, the anthology, yeah.
And you have a birthday coming up. Is that to celebrate your birthday? Isn't that right?
You know, I never thought about that until you just said it. I had no idea. You know what's really crazy about this? I know this is really embarrassing. People would think I'm going to embellish the truth, but this is the God's honest truth. The other day, I knew my birthday was coming up, and I literally forgot how old I was. I knew the range, but like how old? And you know, I was laying on the couch on the iPad, and I Wikipedia'd myself.
Wow.
And I'm like, this
What
is a surreal moment. I'm like, I'm actually going on Wikipedia to find how old am I?
Yeah, right. What if they were wrong and
Yeah, right.
you're living a lie, you're like, who am I?
Well, for whatever it's worth, my daughters and my wife tell me I'm a 3-year-old child, and it's probably true. I'm growing up, but I kind of still act the same. I may have the Tommy Lee syndrome.
Oh wow.
Sorry,
Yeah,
not
right.
that bad.
Oh
Sorry.
wow. You're gonna need the shots and for
Right.
that. Well, so what about shows and stuff like that, playing live and stuff like that?
Yeah, so we're working on a new like full length record as well outside of the anthology right now,
Cool.
which would probably release, my assumption is probably mid 2023 or towards summer. And then we just hired a manager for the first time. We're letting someone in managing the band. His name's Giles Lavery. He's really passionate about the band, lives in Europe. So, you know, and it was kind of his idea to do the anthology. And the reason we brought him in this is we really thought, you know what, let's give someone who's really passionate about the band, who really loves the band, this versus a lot of management companies we could easily use, but I don't think they'd really have the love, at least outside of making the money they'd make, right? For the band. So because of that, you know, Giles is now, he I guess he told me the other day, I mean, agents now in Europe want us, America as well. So I think what's probably going to happen is we'll most likely go out and do a 2023 tour Europe, Japan, and then hopefully United States, which has always been a sore spot for us because we live here, for God's sakes. It's right. one country. We're not popular.
Yeah, come
it's
on, like, people.
Great. Yeah.
Well, my goal is, you know, that's why I do this, to let people know, you know, about, you know, real music and great music that maybe they've been missing out on. But you know what? It's a great idea to have this anthology to come out and then give some of the fans that maybe didn't know about you or can hear and said, man, this stuff is awesome. And then, by the way, we got a new album coming out. And they're like, boom, you know, and then that's how you take off, you know, is because.
Well, listen, and thank you so much for you doing that. I do. I mean, seriously, from the bottom of our heart, we appreciate that. You know, people in America, for the most part, outside of our little, I always laugh and say, like, the 15 minute of fame, you know, in the late 80s, we were on MTV quite a bit. Yeah. You know, we sold a lot of records.
Right.
And, you know, we had some decent tours. But the reality is, the band has always been quite large in places like Japan and certain countries within continental Europe. And I mean big. I mean, we've been lucky where we've played festivals. To be fair, the festivals usually are being headlined by people like Iron Maiden.
Sure.
But we're usually up very top. In other words, as a matter of fact, you said Neil Sean. I remember we did Sweden Rock Festival, and they have like 8 or 9 stages, something ridiculous. They have tons and tons of bands, and then they have a headlining stage. And I remember the festival we played when we did Sweden Rock. It was Impellitteri first, followed by Journey, followed by Dream Theater. I don't know how they got over Journey, followed by Black Sabbath.
Wow.
And then you had other stages, had bands like Europe, and I think at that time it was like, you know, the Twisted Sister bands and, you know, the thrash bands and all that. But the point being is, you know, here we are, America, people go, who are you guys? Like, you know, again, Penicillin. And in certain places in Europe and Japan, you know, we can literally play like arenas and stadiums. I mean, we did a thing called the Busan Rock Festival, which was our first show actually in Korea. And my bass player, James Pulley, couldn't go. I think he had like visa issues. And my buddy, Rudy Sarzo, he actually came in, learned all our music, spent like 2 weeks recording with us or rehearsing, and flew to Korea to do this headlining show for us. And we didn't know what to expect, right? We did sound check, went back to our hotel. We went back that night. I remember Rudy kind of looking at me and I'm like, what? You know, when you're at these big festivals, you walk up, we call it like the walk of death. You're walking up this big ramp up on the stage, you know, or the stairs.
Right.
And as soon as we got to the top of the stairs, looked out, it was like 30 or 40,000 people came to see us.
Oh, wow.
And you know, and so people here in America think, oh, these guys are going to play for 2 people in a club. And they may be right. But in other countries, we're playing in front of 30,000 people headlining, or doing festivals very close to headlining slots. So,
It doesn't seem, I mean, it's just weird how that is. You know, you go over there, and I guess, What do you think is the number one reason why America hasn't been such huge fans like, say, Japan or somebody like that?
Well, America has always been, it's very much like who you know, right? Think about where we are in pop culture today. I mean, heavy metal and rock music, although it can sell out stadiums and arenas easily in America, it's rarely talked about on TV. I mean, even watch things like the Grammy Awards, and it's treated like the plague.
It's awful.
You know, they don't even televise it. Radio doesn't, with the exception of classic, right?
Right.
They don't embrace it. So, you know, the problem is, and the reason being, and let's be honest, I mean, I know enough people, big people in the industry. I know the truth behind the scenes. A lot of it is payola. You know, it's like in the 90s, you had a lot of drug money, basically building artists. You know, you want to get them played on radio and you want everybody to talk about them.
Right.
You got to pay.
That's
How do you get that money? Well, I don't know. Let me see. If you got like money that you need to launder, that's probably a great place to do it.
Sure.
Now, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. Maybe I'm on crack for just saying this. But, you know, it just seems like America is very, I don't know. It seems like it's a very incestuous, manipulated, bought entertainment entity, right? Like you build brands, but it's not necessarily what people really want. People are fed. It's almost like they're force fed to listen to artists. You hear it enough, you finally believe, oh, it must be great.
That's true.
You know, there are plenty of bands I hear and go, oh my god, you gotta be, this sucks, are you kidding me? You know, but maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm just being old. I don't know.
I believe you're right, because that's why I do, like, you know, this podcast, you know, I call it Real Music, is because sometimes the best stuff you have to find, like a treasure, you accidentally stumble across it, because the people aren't going to show you the good stuff. They're going to force feed you the stuff that they want you to like you said. So, but the good stuff is out there. You just got to find it.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, you know, the one thing someone did ask me, why did we get so much success in Japan? You know, and people think, you know, it used to be when we were kids, I used to hear people go, oh, if you can't be famous here, success, just go to Japan to be popular, which is just not true. You know, in Japan, I mean, we've always competed with the bands like Metallica and Ozzy and the biggest bands there. And people asked, why have we been able to, you know, sometimes beat them, like, you know, on the covers of magazines, whatever. And I realized, I think it's because the music has to speak, because remember, there's a language barrier. So you can't convince them to like you, no. Right? You can't buy their affection. You have to earn it through your music and your performance.
That's right.
And in Japan, it kind of proves the point that, wow, I guess we did something right, because we could manipulate them to like us. You know, it was basically, it was almost like the best man or best band wins.
Right. And you're not being hidden or, you know, covered up so they can't hear it, you know, or you're not being muted and things like that, like in America.
Yeah, exactly. And believe, in America, believe me, there are times where I've heard, like, you know, where people badmouth us, right? Other bands or whatever, putting us down so they could, you know, get the spot, right? They could get the coverage, get the magazines.
Sure.
I mean, there were times where I would hear from fans, you know, thank God they were friends. They would call me and go, dude, you wouldn't believe what they just said about you or the band or whatever, right? And it's like, I remember one year we were looking at management at this time, and we had spoke with I won't say who the manager was, but managed one of the big, you know, like the big four type, right? Yeah. Thrash bands.
Right.
And I remember, I'll never forget, on the phone, it's like, man, music's great, really love this, but he goes, your vocals sound like Boston and Queen. I was like, oh dude, thank you. He's like, no, I'm not, that's not a compliment.
Wow.
And he was, at this time it was more like the time where White Zombie's big or Pantera.
Yeah.
And I'm like, really? And, you know, and of course, then they talk crap about us, right? Like, you know, make fun of us for playing too many notes or being too technical or whatever. So their artists would get the spotlight, right? They would get the love.
Sure.
You know, and that's America. We're in Japan. They can't get away with that because you have the problem of communication. There's right. a language barrier. So it's not so easy to manipulate that and convince them to not like somebody.
That's true. And somehow, some way, I don't know how it can be done. It needs to switch around and come back this way through the, you know, that process. Maybe some people will realize one day, you know what, maybe we're not hearing the good stuff. And if it's popular over there, we need to listen to this stuff. You know, yeah. We need to check these guys out.
Yeah. I always got to be careful when I talk about our band, because I don't want to sound like, you know, we're the greatest thing ever. You know, I just know that the people that hear our music, we always get the same thing. It's like, oh my God, why aren't you guys bigger than you are, or huge, or why aren't you popular here? We get the same thing over and over again.
Sure.
You know, and we've always said the same thing. You know, it's like, well, look, we can't help it. We get ignored by the media, or if people simply condemn us or don't like us, you know, we can't buy in, right? We can't, I guess we could, but we're not going to do that.
Right.
It's like, we want people to like us because they really like us. We don't want to force ourselves on them or buy our way in.
Well, I'll just wrap it up and say, you know, that I appreciate you. Talking to me today, and I'm hoping for all the best for your box set and everything. And I will be putting it out there. I got, you know,
Hey man, in all sincerity, I mean, I really appreciate it. I know you're going out of your way, and every time anybody like promotes us, I'm grateful. Seriously, I mean, you know, you guys don't have to do that. So we're certainly honored to, you know, meet your presence and, you know, have you kind of support the band.
Sure, no problem.
Probably, you know, well, I guess we'll see where this goes.
Hey, you know? Well, I'm hoping all the best, and I'm looking forward to seeing good things from you, and thanks for talking to me today.
Okay, thanks so much, too. I really do appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye.
Hello everybody, Gary Stuckey here. Thanks for listening to another episode. I appreciate you taking the time to listen. And if you'd like to help out this podcast, you can do so by clicking on the support button and donating any amount of money that you feel like. And I appreciate it so much. And be sure to check out my YouTube channel, the same name, Real Music with Gary Stuckey. And thanks so much. And whatever you do, keep the music real.